with Mr. Freddie Marsh, and this is taking place at Mr. Marsh's residence on June 11, 2001. Yeah, Mr. Marsh, I just would like to know, what was it like growing up in Valley Falls, Kansas?
Well, I was, of course, I was born there, but I only lived there till I was 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
And I moved to Chicago, okay. And I grew up and went all through school in Chicago.
Okay. And was it after your career that you settled in Corey, or was it like, I just wondered on that.
Yeah, the reason I settled in Corey, of course, is because I married a Corey girl.
Okay.
And the way that came about was my first year of pro ball, which was in 1942. I had played in the Mid-Atlantic League, which Erie
had us.
We're in that league. And when we came to Erie to play, I met my wife. She was working in Erie in a eating place where I ate. So I went in the service then for 3 years.
Okay.
And before I got out of the service, we got married.
But that was during World War II?
World War II. So after World War II, I came here to Corey with her, and I've lived here ever since.
Huh. That's pretty interesting. Was it, and did you play for the Erie Sailors?
No, I played against them. I played for in Ohio.
Okay.
Most of the teams were in Ohio.
Yeah, that's because I know I've got a couple, because really I've looked a lot at Erie baseball history and stuff, and I know that was like one of the highest like classifications that Erie ever had. It was in that Mid-Atlantic League. So.
Yeah, that was the only two teams that weren't in Ohio were Erie and Charleston, West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise it was State and Canton. I still can't. So that was, I was 18 years old, just out of high school.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a fellow in Erie now that played for the Erie Sailors that I haven't met.
Yeah, the Heinrich. Yeah,
yeah.
They did the newspaper. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know a couple of his sons are playing, or I'm not sons, I think grandsons play for Harbor Creek.
Yeah.
And I played for McDowell. And
yeah,
we played against them. So mm-hmm. They were good ball players, too.
Yeah. Well, he was on that Erie team, but I've never met him since.
Oh, yeah.
But I know I've seen his name in the paper.
That's pretty interesting. Just about your family, did you have a large family, and what was your father's occupation?
My father was a plasterer. Well, he grew up as a farmer in Kansas, but then when he went to Chicago, he became a plasterer, house plasterer.
Okay.
But he was always interested in playing ball. He played ball when he was a kid. And we used to go to the Chicago Cubs games when I was a boy.
Uh-huh.
And he always helped me, push me.
Oh, yeah.
You know how dads are.
Yeah.
but it was okay with me. I was all gung-ho.
That's kind of like, because I know my dad, he played for like Penn State Barron, and he had a pretty good like high school career and stuff, but yeah, that was kind of thing. I would thought like he would kind of like push me along more. He's just kind of like, yeah, if you want to play, then sometimes I would have liked it. Sometimes I had to push him to get out there and play catch with me.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And just with the being a farmer, was it tougher? Like I know like in the 20s and the 30s, was it kind of tougher to be a farmer? Because I know with like some of the crop prices, it was with like overproduction, it was kind of tough to like farm during that period, and with the whole Dust Bowl.
Well, of course, I was, I left there when I was 5 years old, so I didn't know much about it, really.
Okay.
That the farm, I didn't know much about the farm life.
Oh, okay.
Went to Chicago when I was five.
Huh. Okay. All right, and you said, I know your father kind of like helped you out. Was there, like, do you remember like listening to a lot of like a baseball, and like how did you, more, did your brothers play a lot? Did that kind of help your interest?
I didn't have any brothers. I just had one sister.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But it was during the Depression, of course, and there was kids didn't have the television. They didn't have stuff that they had. the only thing we could do was go out and play ball every
day.
That's what we did every day, was play ball. And from morning till night, when we weren't in school, well, we were playing ball.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing I always read about Chicago during that time, is even the Chicago Cubs players with all the Negro League teams in the area, what they would do so often is just like they'd play their games in the big leagues, and then just to make an extra 10, 15 bucks, they'd play in some of the Negro League games and the exhibitions and stuff. Yeah. And I just always thought that was so interesting, because nowadays, like in like Erie, you might go see the SeaWolves game, but I mean back during that time, you could just see a game on the corner anyways.
Right.
You go out, watch a game, play a game.
Yeah, we had, well, I grew up playing softball, of course. I never played baseball until I was a sophomore in high school.
Oh, yeah.
It was just softball all the time, and, you know, and there was neighborhood teams, and we'd play, you know, there's never any grown people involved, like no Little League or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, we just, we had teams, and we'd go play other neighborhoods, and just played all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, what was the high school you attended in Chicago?
It was Steinmetz High School. Steinmetz.
Okay.
And
I know like back then, like, was the high school leagues well organized? Was there like a state championship and
yes,
all that?
Okay. Yeah. Well, we didn't play in the state championship. We just played the city championship.
We never played
for the state.
Okay.
In my sophomore year and in my senior year, we won the city championship in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And there was, if I remember right, there was about, just about 40 high schools in Chicago.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I know that's a lot like the basketball and stuff with like the Philadelphia. Now they have just so many high schools that they really they can play their own championships.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's the way that was.
Oh, all right.
Okay. And we had and there was four sections. The was divided up into four sections, and then you had a semifinals and then the finals.
Oh, okay. Good.
And we always played the finals in Wrigley Field. So
wow.
Twice I played in Wrigley Field when I was in high school.
Wow, that's pretty neat. Okay. Yeah, like I was saying about the semi-pro and the Negro League teams, do you remember as a youngster, like, seeing like, not so much Chicago, because I know, like, you'd just see the professional teams, but do you remember some, like, barnstorming teams coming through the town, and did you remember, like, some of the Negro League teams that you might have seen?
No, I never did.
Oh, yeah.
I never did see any Negro League teams. I lived on the far northwest side of Chicago.
Oh.
And the colored section was on the far south side of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
It was probably 50 miles away.
Okay. that's a big area. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Like you said, you started out playing like sandlot ball, and then you moved. Was there like any American Legion teams back then?
No, but they had city parks, and they had park leagues in the summertime.
Oh, all right.
The park that I was closest to, they only had one baseball diamond. They had a Sunday league, and they had an evening league. The evening league, they had an evening league with 17 and under, and then they had the evening league of 17 and over, and then the Sunday league was unlimited. And I played in all, between the time that I was, my junior year in high school, to my senior year that summer, I played in over 100 games.
Wow.
that were umpired by regular umpires.
Oh, yeah. Like, wow.
See, because in this park league, I played two games. I played five games every week.
Wow.
Within those three leagues. And they didn't conflict because they only had one field.
Oh, yeah.
and then in the high school spring, the high school league, between the league games and the practice games that the coach, we probably played 30 games.
Oh, yeah.
In the high school part of the spring.
Yeah, because I know, like, in the American Legion, even nowadays, they might play 60 games a season. So,
yeah
that's another, like, just a great thing about that era. I mean, you could just really get out, because I know it's so tough for, like, me nowadays just to grab up eight guys, even to, like, maybe play, like, four-on-four baseball.
Right.
Who even can really play that?
Right.
That's
a good thing about a big, one good thing about a big city is you always have enough guys that want to play.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to play basketball, there's guys that's playing basketball all summer long.
Right.
If you want to play baseball, you can play baseball all, as long as you can play.
Right.
Football's the same way.
Yeah.
Just like in high school. Now, we didn't have a very big high school. We had about 4,000 kids in high school. But there's very few guys that could make more than one team.
Oh, yeah. You had to kind of zero in on
it. You had to kind of zero in on one thing. No matter how good you were, why, the guys that played football, they played football so much that if you didn't play football all the time, why, you couldn't compete with them.
Yeah.
So the guys that played baseball played baseball. The guys that played basketball were a different bunch of guys. And the guys that played football were a different bunch of guys.
Yeah, that's kind of like how you see in, like, some of, like, 50s and 40s, like, when the TV shows, you see, here comes the football team, and it's just kind of what they do.
I mean, yeah.
That's interesting.
And the schools were pretty good size. One school that we always competed against a lot and was a school called Lane Technical High School. They had all boys, 9,000 boys.
Wow. Yeah, you get a pretty good draw of athletes.
They had pretty good teams.
Wow. Yeah, like, what positions did you play mostly growing up? I know, like, really, when you first start out, you just kind of try everything out and see, like...
I was always a shortstop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Until I got into pro ball, then I started playing all a lot of different positions.
Oh, yeah. And, what were you, like, a Cubs fan growing up? Or
I was on that side of town. I was on the north side of town where the Cubs are.
Oh, okay. Who would you say was your favorite player growing up?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
That's like, because I know, like, the early Cubs, because I know a lot about, like, the dead ball era, that early, like, with the Tinkers, Evers, Chance, and then I know Ernie Banks and up that era, but, yeah, I really wasn't sure too much about, like, the 20s and up till, like, the 30s there about the Cubs. I just haven't learned too much about that.
Yeah, when I was growing up was in the late 30s when I was there. I graduated from high school in 41. And the Cubs had pretty good teams. They won a pennant there in, I don't know what.
I think 40, I know 45 is the last year they were back in the World Series.
But I think in about 38, Gabby Hartnett was a catcher. And,
okay,
and I remember when he hit a famous home run in the dark off of the Pittsburgh in the last week of the season to beat Pittsburgh out for the pennant.
Oh, yeah.
And then they played a World Series against the Yankees, but they got the Yankees beat them 4 straight.
Oh, yeah, and then 39, that was like one of the best Yankees teams ever right after that. So
I went to one of those games.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember my dad taking me to one of those games.
That's pretty neat. And did your father kind of like want you to try to make a career out of baseball and the rest of your family?
Well, yeah, he always helped me. In other words, I didn't realize it when I was small, but he worked hard as a plasterer. I mean, he worked really hard. But he would come home and he would hit me ground balls, and I didn't realize it at the time, but later on I realized, you know, that he really went the extra mile to help me.
Yeah.
Because he was so tired, but he'd get out there and he'd work with me.
Yeah, that's kind of like with the Field of Dreams thing that they always thought, like how, like, Kevin Costner's father, how he always used to, like, work all day and he'd get out there and he'd be tired hitting them home, like, ground balls, and he wouldn't want to be getting ground balls, but yeah, it's,
yeah.
That's
same thing.
Yeah, it's, and how old were you when you were signed, and who signed you? Like, was it, I just kind of wondered, like, were they, like, were you playing sandlot ball and they, like, a scout saw you? Or?
Well, they signed me right out of high school.
Oh, okay.
It was all what they call all the scouts have what they call they have guys that look, you know, like guys that are umpires or coaches.
Oh, okay.
You know, that tell them about people who are pretty good ball players.
Okay.
And then they come to see them. And the Chicago Cubs signed me when I was 17 years old.
Okay.
I graduated from high school when I was 17.
Oh, okay.
And they signed me right out of high school.
All right.
And, but of course, that was in about this time of the year, about June the 15th, when our high school was over. And so they gave me my I could go out to the minor leagues right then.
Yeah.
Or they had a school down at Wrigley Field that in the mornings, and they had good coaches, big league coaches, a lot of them were there, and they had a bunch of guys down there. And some guys around the park that had played minor league ball, they told me, they said, don't bother going out to the minor leagues in the middle of the year. All you'll do is just sit on a bench. Just go down to that school. That'd be. So that's what I did. So I didn't go out that year to the minor leagues. But then the next year I did.
Okay.
Next spring, then, when I was 18.
Yeah, was it kind of like this, the school at Wrigley, was it kind of like, did you have like some games that you still played in?
Yeah, you had games. There was probably, there might have been 30 or 40 guys there. And they would get instructions, you know, the pitchers and the infielders and the hitters. And then we played a game every day. And then after the game, they gave you a buck. And you stayed and watched the big league game.
Oh, yeah. That's very neat.
Yeah,
it's better than playing.
So that's what I did that first summer that they signed me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's
rather than to go out to the minor league somewhere.
You get to play at Wrigley Field every day. That wouldn't be too bad.
Yeah.
Were they still in Williamsport, the single A affiliate? Because I know that's where they are today.
What do you mean?
The single A, like when they said like you could go to the minor league.
Well, I don't know where. Okay. Back then, the minor leagues are so much different today than they were back then. Before television, there was a minor league club almost every place in this country that there was a town as big as Corey.
Yeah.
And down, especially down in the Carolinas and down in Georgia and down around there, every little team had a minor league club. And every big league club furnished ball players to these clubs. But it didn't cost a big league club anything because of these little clubs. The people came out and watched the ball games, and they supported, and they supported them enough to pay the to pay these players.
Oh, yeah.
Even though the big league clubs owned them and farmed them out, anybody that was a halfway decent ball player could find a place to start. I mean, they had AAA, AA, A, B, C, D.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I mean a lot of D clubs.
Yeah.
Just all over the place.
Yeah, because I know they always used to talk about A, B, C, D, but then did they still have the AAA, AA, and that's a lot of leagues.
Yeah, and there was, you know, that like there was three AAA leagues back then, and AA leagues, there was three or four AA leagues, and then more B leagues and more C leagues and more D leagues. But they don't even have half the minor league clubs that they used to have.
Oh, yeah. While you were in the minor leagues, did you, like, and you were playing your way up, did you have any famous teammates or managers that guide you on your way?
Oh, most of them were not famous, you know, because most of them back then were guys that had played quite a lot, but they never got to the top.
Oh, okay.
But there was jobs, and so they just kept on, they managed, and they weren't big name people usually.
Okay. Yeah, because I know a lot of players like back then used to, after they'd be in their prime in the majors, they might come back to the minors for a while and just try to get a couple more years out of their skills.
Well, yeah, most people did that. I did that myself. I played 2 years after I left the majors. Another 2 years in the minors before. But when you leave the majors and you go down to the minors, well, then they start cutting your salary down.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when they cut my salary down enough so that I could make just as much staying home as I stayed home.
Okay. Okay, and on what date did you enter the major leagues, and what memories did you have of that day?
Well, of course, I went to spring training with Cleveland twice.
Okay.
Once in 1949.
Was that still in Arizona?
Okay. In Tucson.
Yeah, okay.
And in 1949, I went to spring training with Cleveland, and I stayed with them, and I was with them opening day.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, I got in a ball game on opening day. I ran for a guy, Danny Peck. He was a pinch hitter, but he had bad knees. And so I got in the ball game in the first game of the season in 1949. And then in 50, I didn't go to spring training with him that year. But then in 51, I went to spring training with him again. And then 2 weeks before the season started, they traded me to the Browns, and then I stayed in the
baseball. Oh, so yeah, because that's, I did see in the baseball encyclopedia for 1949, it had you down for the one game there. It was kind of like the Moonlight Graham situation.
But yeah, yeah. It was opening day. And after opening day, of course, in 48, you know, they won the pennant.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And so, they, you know, Boudreau was the manager, and they had Keltner and Gordon and all those guys. And they were all still there then in 49.
Oh, yeah.
So you weren't going to make that team. and they were just looking for a place to farm me out.
Huh.
And so after opening day, well, then they farmed me out to Sacramento in the Pacific Coast League.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, I know, I know for Sacramento that Joe Dugan, he played, because I've looked at some home run records, and I saw that I think he hit like 59 home runs in 1 year, and that's what a lot of people, like, they don't really look at the minor league, like, home run records and stuff, but there's, like one, I know, I can't think of his name, but they always talk about the 4,000 hit club being Ty Cobb and Pete Rose, but I can't think of his name right off the top of my head, but there was another minor leaguer, Walt Wallach. He might have spent 2 years in the majors. He still ended up with 4,000 hits.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And how did you feel that day? Was it kind of like when Lou Boudreau just said, like, needed somebody off the bench, and he like pointed you out to run out there? Was it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was on the team. I was sitting there, and I could. I was young and could run. And so when this guy pinch hit seventh inning or something, whatever it was. Like that, why then you just call me, go in and run for them. And I didn't run for them.
Huh. Was that at League Park? Or?
No, that was at the open season in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. At Sportsman's.
Yeah,
okay.
Sportsman's Park.
Huh. That's, did they, was it, because I know, like you said, you ended up with the Browns. Did they, like, ever, like, in spring training, did they ever, like, did the Browns ever see you in action some that kind of, like, that they saw, like, your talent? Did they ever, was that?
Well, you know, back then, it's the same way today. Why, all the scouts know all the, what's available.
Oh, okay.
You know, they know what's out there. They know the kids that are coming up. They know, the scout for some other team knows what Cleveland's got, and they all know one another's talent.
Okay. Yeah, one thing what you said about in Tucson, was that at High Corbett Field there that you had spring training?
It doesn't sound like
it. Because I know, like, I know the Indians were there for, it might have been in the 50s, like 60s later, but because I know the Rockies trained there, and that's kind
of... Well, maybe, I don't know as I know the name of the field.
Oh, okay.
But that it was the 50s, of course, I was there in 49 and then 51, so...
Oh, okay.
It was probably the same field.
Alright. Okay, and, like I said, kind of like the Moonlight Graham thing, did the game in 49 kind of motivate you to get back to the majors? Was it kind of like seeing, like this, was it kind of like a great feeling to be finally up there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a great feeling to be up there. And, of course, I knew that I wasn't going to stay. I mean, you know. You know, you can look around you and you can see who's there. And you know you're not one of the top 25.
Yeah.
And so you know that you're not going to be there. What's going to happen to you, you just wait and see. And of course, whatever happens to you, why, you're always trying to claw your way back up to the big leagues.
That's the thing, like, it's just really with only like 16 teams, and even now with the 29 teams that they, or 30 I believe it is now, they had their 40-man rosters. I mean, it was just, that's the biggest thing, like, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, you think, let me see it in here, make sure I wanted to, because I wrote it well, I wanted to see how I wrote. Yeah, it was, did you feel with the 16 teams in the majors it was rather difficult to have a long career? Because I know with like only the 25-man rosters, and some teams had even less than that. But did you think it was kind of difficult to really, to stay in the top, the talent?
Well, yeah, of course, it's always difficult because there's always all these minor league guys back there that are trying to get your job.
Yeah.
And you gotta try to keep your job. So you gotta do what you gotta do to keep your job.
That's the whole, like, with the making the whole free agent thing with Kurt Flood so big. It's just because really back then it was, I mean, baseball was even more of a challenging thing than just like a regular job, because you know, it's with a, like with, say if you're an iron worker, you, I mean there could be another like person out there, but there's no like statistics to judge the two iron workers. But with baseball, you just ever, like you'll have five guys nipping at your heels for your position.
Right.
You
see? Yep.
And it's just that's I don't think enough players realize that today, that it was just, I mean they might, I mean even if they have somebody replace them, they still got to get their contract to pay for the rest of the
year.
Well,
what people don't realize is the average life in the big leagues of a big league ball player is, I think it's less than 2 years.
Yeah.
Because of the guys that come and go.
Yeah, I mean with the, yeah,
you know, all you hear about is the guys that are there for 15 years, you know, the big names.
Yeah.
But all the guys that come and go underneath them, you know, you don't hear about.
Yeah, it's, yeah, like with like the major league draft, I mean they draft like I just the other day, like I think it's like 100 rounds or something, and I know like one of the relief pitchers for the Devil Rays, I think he set the record. He was drafted in like the 89th round the other day, and I think it's the last name Phelps. I know he has a couple saves with him, and it's just, I think he set the record for being the latest round and actually get to the majors.
Yeah.
I mean, and like Mike Piazza, I think he was drafted in like the 15th round. I mean, and there's supposed to be guys in front of him that could like play, that could catch better. I mean, it's,
well, there, you know, there's guys that develop later sometimes,
yeah,
and some guys develop real soon and look good against their competition but never get any better, and then there's the guys, like I say, that don't look too good but then they progress,
yeah,
until they're great, like Piazza.
Yeah. Yeah, like how would you describe, were you a big swinger or did you hit more for average?
I never hit many home runs. Huh. In the minor leagues in my good years I only hit about 10 or 12 home runs. Huh. Of course, okay. Nobody hit a whole lot of home,
yeah,
runs.
Yeah, that's
back then.
Yeah, because like I know like in the early like part of the century, I know they always talk about using like the balls getting all scuffed up, and like by the end of the game, it's just this mushy thing that they're throwing with all kind of spit all over it and stuff. Was it back then? Did they like would they use a lot of balls during the games? Would like if?
Well, you mean big league games?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they used about as many big, well, maybe they weren't quite as fussy back then as they are now. But they didn't use any balls that were scuffed up.
Yeah, yeah.
Much, like that. No,
yeah.
They didn't give the pitcher that much advantage.
Yeah. Okay. And was it like, with your swing and your style, like fielding and your throw, did you copy any past major leaguers' style?
I don't think so, because as I was growing up, while we played ball so much, you know, it's, They have little leagues today, and they have coaches, and these coaches are trying to tell the kids how to do things.
Yeah,
you know, I think my own estimation is that if a kid plays enough, he'll end up doing it the right way, because that's the best way to get it done.
Yeah, it's
you know, if you do it the wrong way and it doesn't turn out very good, you're gonna change. You're gonna,
yeah,
do it the right way, and I think that's the way we were. We just played ball so much that we did it the right way. We knew what to do with the ball when we got it during the game, because we just did it all our life, you might say.
Yeah, and I think it kind of adds a little flavor to it, because I mean, if I know when I was like in like Pony League, Major League, our coach was like here's the step back when you pitch, and then yeah, you want to get into the like power position with your leg up. I mean, I just think it'd be so boring to see 300 pitchers in the majors pitch exactly the same. I mean,
yeah.
I like the little little idiosyncrasies that they all have, and it makes it interesting.
Yeah.
And back to spring training, was there a lot of instruction, like, or would you think was there more like time spent playing like tune-up games?
It's a funny thing how baseball has changed in spring training.
Huh.
There's three different phases that I'm seeing. Before I got there, the major league ball players, of course, major league ball players weren't put on a pedestal like they are today.
Yeah.
they didn't make all that much money, and they didn't have so much competition because they weren't looked up to so much, and but they would go to spring training, and spring training was to get in shape. I mean, they'd go to spring training 20,
yeah,
30 pounds overweight. And that's what spring training was for, is to lose the weight and to get in shape to play. Now, when I went to spring training, why, it changed. You better not come to spring training 30 pounds overweight. But you weren't in shape either.
Yeah.
And you weren't in shape, but you better not be overweight like those guys were in the era before. And so you come to spring training, and you played a lot of practice games and got to get in shape. And those guys back there, they'd be in spring training for 3 weeks before they ever played a game.
Oh, yeah.
They were, you know, they lose weight primarily.
Yeah, that's what, like nowadays, like, they'll, I think, like, really the running and the getting in shape, like, cardiovascular, I mean, that's just thrown aside. I mean, you got baseball players saying, I'm not an athlete, I'm a baseball player.
Well, yeah, but you see, now, that was when my era was, you better be, your weight better be pretty close. But then you had to get in shape. Huh. Nowadays, guys come and they're pumping iron.
Yeah.
I mean, they're strong. They've been working out all winter, and so there's kind of, it's changed.
Yeah.
It changes.
Okay. And who was the most interesting and influential coach that you ever worked with?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose the manager that I liked the best and that liked me was the guy that managed the White Sox. Richards. Paul Richards.
Oh, okay.
He liked me pretty well. It's probably the reason I stayed in the big leagues as long as I did. Because he traded for me from the Browns to the White Sox, and I was with the White Sox then for 2 years. And then at the end of the second year, he took over the Baltimore Orioles.
Oh, okay.
And he traded for me right away. Huh. And I went with him to Baltimore, and I was with Baltimore with him for 2 years.
Huh.
So he was the most instrumental, I suppose, in my ball playing.
Okay. And what would you say was your favorite big league park and why?
I don't know. Probably, of course, I never played on artificial turf.
Yeah.
And parks are just parks. Everyone is different.
Yeah. Do you think at the time, because I know, Yankee Stadium, it still kind of had its, 298 fence back then and, was really lefty-friendly, but do you think during the times, the parks were, more tailored to home run hitting still, or was it more, pitchers and triples? Kind of ballparks.
Well, yeah, it was, there was not so much, the parks weren't made for home runs like they are today.
Yeah.
there was a lot of long fences, a lot of long, long center fields.
Yeah, like Braves Field, I was just reading about it, 530 or something, I mean, that's incredible.
Well, in Yankee Stadium, the center field, they had these monuments out right in the field.
Yeah.
They were so far back, though. they knew nobody'd ever get in trouble with them.
Yeah, that's what I was asking my dad the other day, and he wasn't really sure, but yeah, you know the black seats that they have out there now, like the bleacher section in Yankee Stadium where they don't sit, was that kind of like center field in the past?
No doubt, because it was way over, almost 500 feet out there, you know, there was a flagpole and these monuments right in the field. But they were so far back that nobody ever hit a ball back there.
Yeah, that's what, because they make, they say, it's, the biggest thing when they hit one in those black section back there, and I just, I could see if that was, the real center field back then, that would be, you get, a home run there, two a season or something.
Yeah, guys would hit a ball hard. I mean, it would go a mile back there, you know, and guys would run back and catch them.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Nowadays, they're all home runs.
Yeah. did you have a favorite umpire? Really, did you the one you felt that gave you an edge at all?
No, I don't think so. Umpires were. They didn't muck you around with the ball players much. They just did their job, and they were pretty. They didn't joke around with you at all.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Did they still use? I know they used to use only one umpire, but how many were they using at this time?
No, they had. They usually had three umpires.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know I umpire.
Sometimes they would only have two, but a lot of time they would have three.
Oh, yeah, because I know I just umpire youth leagues, and most of the time we normally go with two, and I read about, like, early in the century they'd go with one, and just all the tricks they'd pull on them, like the cut play and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of, but I really, it's like basically impossible with the four umpires now to really get to pull anything by them. Okay, and just on a side, were you ever thrown out of a game, or were there ever any memorable team fights that you remember?
No, I was never thrown out of a game. Well, they didn't have many team fights back then.
Yeah, that's the thing that they always talk about now is, like, with how, like, guys are getting so, their egos are so much that if they get a ball inside, they got to go whine.
Yeah.
And
yeah, back then, you know, it was, you know, everybody threw at people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
I remember I was playing for, I don't know if it was Baltimore, or I guess it was Baltimore, and I was playing at the old Cleveland Stadium against Cleveland. Early Wynn was pitching, and Jim Hegan was the catcher. And Wynn was pitching a good game, and I got a hold of a ball, and it was going down the left field line. It was going to be out of the ballpark, but whether it would be foul or fair, and it just went foul. And I didn't think anything about it, you know. I picked up the bat and got back in the batter's box, and next, here come the ball right at me. And I hit the dirt, and I looked up at Hegan, and he hadn't even reached for the ball. He was just sitting back there like a catcher. He just let it go. And he said to me, you know, Fred, you've been hitting this pretty good lately. And I says, Jim, when you go back to the dugout, you tell Early that's the best compliment I ever had.
To get thrown at.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
But guys, you know, guys got knocked down and got hit all the time. And it's no big deal.
Yeah, that's like they always say, like with Willie Mays. I mean, if he'd hit a home run, say off like Bob Gibson, he'd just come up there realizing, okay, throw at me, let's get this over with.
And of course, we didn't have any, we didn't use batting helmets back then.
Oh yeah.
Just a regular hat. And the only guy that I ever saw got beamed never got hurt. Uh-huh. His ball bounced off his head and bounced all the way in the stands, and he ran down to first base. That was it.
All right. And just from like some research, like I was talking about, like the trade, like you were traded to St. Louis, or from St. Louis to Washington in May, and then you were traded back to St. Louis in June. Can you explain why you think these trades took place, and like can you explain your feelings on being moved around so much?
Well, when you're a ball player, you know, that's part of life. You know, you might get traded. It's not a big deal. Well, I know the reason I got traded. It was Bill Veeck was owned the ball club then. And when I came back to St. Louis, Bill Veeck was a kind of a guy that sits down in the dugout and hobnobs with the players a lot. And I said to him, I said, Bill, what's going on? And he says, Fred, he said, the guy named Griffith owned the ball club over at Washington.
Yeah, Clark Griffith.
And he said, I've never been able to make a deal with him. But he said, he kind of thought that he wanted you. And so he said, I traded you over there. He said, I knew I could get you back.
So, yeah, that sounds like Bill Veeck. I mean, like, I'm not sure. I know a little bit about, like, I'm not sure what his name is, but the player he had, the really short play, like, he was 3 foot something, like, either with with the 1/8 on it.
I played in that ball.
Were you? Oh, man, really?
Yeah.
Because just all the things I've heard about it, like Bill Veeck, I mean, yeah. That's pretty interesting.
I saw an article one time that said, in baseball, they have a list of 50 games that are most notable games that have ever been played in baseball.
Oh, yeah.
And that game is in there. Huh. With people, that's one of the 50 most notable games.
Oh, yeah.
And I played in that ballgame.
But where did he play? Was he like a midget?
He was a midget. And he was about this big. Well, he didn't play.
Oh, okay, he was just...
Here's the way it worked. We were in St. Louis, and so we had to go out on the field first. So our leadoff hitter was a center fielder, but there was a substitute in the game for him that day. He was sitting on the bench. And so after the first half of the first inning, when we came in to bat, then it was his So then they took this guy out that started in center field and put Heeble into pinch hit.
Oh, okay.
And when he walked, he went down to first base, and then the regular center fielder come in to run for him.
Oh, okay. Like, was it kind of tough for the pitcher even to get it in the zone? I mean,
And not only that, but he scooched way over like this, you know. The guys, he had a strike zone about that high, you know.
Yeah, I think like Ricky Anderson, people make a big deal out of that. But, I mean, Jesus, it's probably like 6 inches of strike.
So he didn't never be able to play the game.
Oh, okay. It's kind of like a novelty there.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty interesting. And I know from like looking in the encyclopedia about you had a broken elbow and a leg injury in 1955 with the Orioles. Could you explain like what the real rehabilitation was and how injury care was kind of different in the 50s and maybe what it is today?
Well, I don't know what it is today. Of course, I know they have sophisticated doctors and psychiatrists and everything else. Back then, we just had a trainer. But we thought we were getting pretty good care back then compared to what the guys got 20 years before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Spit some tobacco juice on it and go back out there. Was it like, was there a lot that, were you like separated from the team for a while that you had to like do some like separate like rehab? And...
Well, when I had the broken elbow, I went into a wall and I broke my elbow. And I had it in the cast. But during the ball game, I can remember, even with that, the cast was like from here to here. During the ball game, I would stand in the shower room with a tennis ball and throw it up against the wall. And, you know.
Oh, okay.
So after about 2 weeks, why this cast was pretty ragged, and it wasn't long. So like, I don't think I was out of the lineup more than 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's real, like, with all the elbow injuries they have with pitchers now and stuff, out like the Tommy Johns and stuff. That's
they're different. They're not bone.
Yeah. That's right. That's like a ligament.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know with you playing for both the Browns and the Orioles, did you have some feelings with the Browns leaving St. Louis and moving to Baltimore?
No, I wasn't there, of course. I was with the Browns, and then I went to the White Sox for 2 years, and during those 2 years I was with the White Sox is when the Browns moved to Baltimore.
Yeah, 54, I think it was the year. Yeah.
And then in 55, when Paul Richards went to manage the Browns, he took me with him. Oh. So that's when I went over to Baltimore.
Huh, okay. And I know, from looking at the encyclopedia that Satchel Paige played, was it in 51? I know he was St. Louis, I'm not sure, was he with Cleveland too? That in 1949 still.
He was with Cleveland first. He came to Cleveland first, but then he came to the Browns in 52 when Beck. See, Beck didn't own the club in 51 when I was there.
Oh, okay.
I think during the winter of 51, I think Beck bought the club, and so in 52, then he got Satchel Paige.
Oh, okay.
To play with the Browns.
What was that? Did that deal have any coinciding with your? With the trade with you was just two separate deals.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How would you like? I know that was like later in his career, but did he still have like a really great fastball?
He was a pretty fair pitcher. I mean, gosh, I don't know how old he was. I guess nobody else knew either.
Yeah.
but he was still a pretty good pitcher. He could pitch a pretty good ball game for a while, and because one thing about him, he never had much of a curveball, but he was tall and lanky, and he had a pretty sneaky fastball, and he was kind of hard to get sink with. And he had such good control that he hardly ever threw you a good pitch to hit. It was always on the corners or up and down. And so he could still get by, but he was, of course, when he was young, it was altogether different. I've read stories that when the big leaguers used to barnstorm against the color teams, and Joe DiMaggio and those guys said that he was the best pitcher they ever faced.
Yeah, that's, I know, I'm not sure if it was against the major league teams, but when he'd just pitch against other Negro League teams, sometimes he'd have the whole outfield come and sit on the infield grass, and he'd say, okay, I'm going to strike these three guys out, so you guys know that.
Sure.
That's
he was something, all right. He was a character, too. A real character. Nice guy.
in a like how did you kind of know that your baseball career was, because I know you said like in that you said you played in the minors 2 years after in Baltimore, but how were you sent down like from Baltimore? Was it
What happened was we were playing up in Boston, and I was playing second base, and there was a man on first base, and there was a man on second base, and the ball came to the shortstop, and he threw it to me at second base, and I could see that I had the guy at third base rather than go to first base for the double play. And so I stepped towards third base to throw the ball, and the guy that was coming from first base clipped me.
Oh, he came in.
He came in and clipped me, and he sprained an ankle so bad that, I mean, it puffed up like that before I even got off the field. And I hung around trying, and it got better, and then I would run and run and run, but I couldn't keep from limping. And so finally, they sent me out to Pacific Coast League.
Oh.
Paul Richards, and he sent me out, and he said, you know, get in shape and get that thing healed and so you can come back. But I never did go back. Huh. I never was able to go back.
Huh. Yeah, that's the thing with, like, injuries today and stuff. It's just so much different that if you get injured, oh, we got...
So, you know, it was kind of, you know, they weren't, you know, if I had been 25, why, they'd have probably brought me back. But when you're 35, why, they figured that might as well get somebody younger.
Yeah, that's just the thing, like, how they can, like even with Babe Ruth, how great he was later in his career. I mean, they just kind of casted him aside. I mean, it really it was just kind of like a bunch of owners that, like, they just, it was like a big business to them.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, and, you said you played 2 years in the minors. Was it kind of like after your, both of those were in Sacramento, you said, both those years?
You mean after the big leagues?
Yeah.
No. They sent me to Vancouver.
Oh,
yeah. Actually, Vancouver's in Canada.
Yeah.
But it was one of the Pacific Coast League teams.
I think they might still have a franchise there.
Probably. But, of course, all those big league teams up and down the West Coast, we're all in the Pacific Coast League, then the Triple A.
Yeah, like the Los Angeles Angels and
right. And San Diego and Los Angeles and Frisco and Seattle, they were all Triple A teams.
Yeah.
And I played, so I finished out that year there. Then in 56, the middle of 56. And in 57, and I think I went back to the Texas League.
Oh, okay.
And in 58, I played in the Texas League again, and then I quit.
Okay. Was it, after your career, did you want to do any baseball management after?
No. I had four children, and we traveled around the country a lot. And the kids were getting big enough so that they were getting in school. So I could have managed. Paul Richards would have found me a ball club to manage, but I didn't want to hassle that anymore. So I came back and went to work.
what kind of jobs did you do after you?
Well, when I first came back here, I worked. There was a road construction outfit here in Corry that I worked with for 2 or 3 years. And then I got a job carrying mail for the post office, and I carried mail for 20 years here at the court.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just one other thing I forgot to ask about, while you were the St. Louis Browns, was with the Cardinals there, because I know they had some good years, like, during that time. Was there, like, a big rivalry between the two, or did you think that the Cardinals kind of got, like, the upper hand? I know you both played at Sportsman's Park, but they sometimes get the practice times if they wanted it.
Well, they've been doing that for a long time. They both played at the St. Paul ball park. I mean, if it was a Cardinal day, there was no Browns there, and if it was a Browns day, there was no Cardinals there. Because usually they had it fixed so that one was on the road.
Oh, okay.
While one was home, one was on the road. There was never two of them at home at the same time.
Okay, yeah, kind of like they do with, like, football with the Giants and you and the Jets there. Yeah, okay. I see. With the travel, I was still like mostly train travel, right?
They didn't start using planes much until I was just about done.
Yeah, because I know, Larry McPhail with the Yankees. I can't remember the exact date when, because he was a lot like Bill Veeck, where he wanted to be the innovator, and like I think it might have been the Yankees that he had them the first team to fly. I think that was probably to the West Coast too. So.
Yeah, you see back then, the furthest team west was St. Louis.
Oh yeah.
And the furthest team south was Cincinnati.
Yeah.
So how much of a train ride is it?
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't go from New York to St. Louis. You went from Chicago to St. Louis.
Yeah.
Or from Chicago to Detroit. Or you went about a 6-hour train trip, and usually what happened was they had the train sitting on the siding, and you got done with the ball game and you ate your supper and everything, and you went and you got on the train, and you had sleeper.
Yeah.
And you got the sleeper, and the train took you to the next ballpark, to the next town, and they dropped the train off on a siding at maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when you got there.
Gee.
And you didn't have to get up until 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock. And so that was, it was no big deal because you didn't have far to go.
Yeah, it wasn't like, because that's the thing, like they do with the scheduling. Some days it's kind of like teams will have like an 8,000 mile road trip and stuff. I mean, it's not like, but yeah, I still think it'd be more convenient to have like, just like have a team play like Philadelphia and like Pittsburgh. I mean, at the same time, but
yeah.
they gotta keep their unbalanced schedule now and everything. And as your salary, what do you think your average salary was during your career? And do you think you were always fairly paid?
Well, I was. Well, back then, of course, before flood.
Yeah.
You either played for what they said you played for, or else you went home.
Yeah.
you couldn't say, well, I'll go somewhere else and play. You couldn't. And so the salaries were held down pretty much. I mean, the guys like Ted Williams and Bob Feller and Joe DiMaggio, they made about $100,000, and that was about it.
Yeah.
and the minimum wage, the first year that I played, the minimum wage was $5,000.
Oh, okay.
Now the minimum wage is about $120.
Yeah, because I know it's great. It gradually just keeps going up.
Yeah. that's about the difference. There's about 10 to 15 times difference in how much money that you made.
But was there really like, because I know, like, I'm not sure how long it lasts, because I know they used to have like a salary cap where it was like really like earlier in the century where it was like $2,400 like for a while. But I mean, was there ever any salary cap like on how much you pay?
There was never a salary cap.
Oh, okay.
For the simple reason, they just didn't have to pay you.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the money that's going to the players nowadays used to go to the owners.
Yeah.
Now the owners are not making the money anymore.
Yeah,
the players are.
Yeah, the owners are getting their little bit and thrown in the stock market.
Well, the thing is that the teams used to be owned by families,
yeah,
by individuals. But now they can't do that anymore because they can't stand, one man can't stand to lose the kind of money that ball teams can lose. So almost every team is owned by a conglomerate of some kind.
Yeah.
So if they lose money, they can write them off. Yeah. Write them off as advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the way it goes nowadays.
Yeah. And was there a lot of players discussing salary? I know like nowadays they probably like half the locker room's got their stockbrokers in there, and who knows what. But was there a lot of like salary discussion? And did you have any off season employment that you would do after the season?
I always worked in the off season. I always come home and got a job down one of the plants or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was it when were you married?
I was married in 45.
45, okay. And then every off season would you come back to Corey?
Yeah.
Okay.
I always spent all the winters here. Yeah.
Okay. And did you ever have any players on your team that would just be like a big like salary, like their salary is like a big thing to them? Were they always like holding out? Or did you have any players?
Not much. No. You never knew very well what anybody else made. Hardly ever. I know that Nellie Fox was a pretty good friend of mine, and Nellie was on the All-Star team a lot.
Yeah, did he play in St. Louis? Because I remember what.
No, he played at White Sox.
White Sox, that's it.
But Nellie's salary was around $30,000, and he was on the All-Star team.
Oh yeah. Was there?
Nobody said too much about salaries. Nobody talked about him very much. For one thing, like nobody made that much money.
Yeah. I know, like, nowadays they have, like, all their incentives for making the All-Star team and getting 100 RBIs. Was there any things like that back then?
No.
There wouldn't be, like, any extra pay for making the All-Star team, right?
Well, I never heard of any. I don't know.
Okay.
There might have been a few guys, but most guys, you know, nobody had an agent back then.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't enough money floating around for an agent to make a living. And so consequently, why all the things that agents think up nowadays,
yeah,
where the guys didn't think of them.
Yeah, they were too busy playing ball to worry about how much they're getting paid. Okay, and on a side note, like, would you consider yourself superstitious? Like, was your number you wore, was there any, like, reasoning behind that?
No, I was never superstitious about stepping on the lines or anything else.
So what number did you wear?
Every time I went to a different team, I would have a different number. I think maybe I was 2 with the Browns and 25 with the White Sox, and I don't even remember what I was with the Orioles.
Oh, yeah. And who would you pick, would you say, like, from an All-Star team, from, like, the players that you played with of your time? Like, I just wondered, who do you think was the best at each position? Like,
well, at each position, the best ball player that I know about, including today's ball player, was Willie Mays. He was absolutely the best ball player, in my estimation, that's ever been.
Did you ever get to play against him?
Just in spring training.
Oh, spring training. Okay. Yeah, the Giants, were they in Arizona back then?
Right.
Okay. All right, how do you feel about baseball and its players today, do you think? Do you think the game's, like, changed greatly? Like, I just wonder what you felt about the game today.
Well, everything has changed about the game. You know, the size of the parks, the artificial turf makes it a much different game.
Yeah.
The base stealing, when you're running on dirt, you can't steal the bases that you can running on artificial turf.
Yeah.
Artificial turf has got more traction.
Yeah.
And so all these things, and the balls bounce through the infield, and they go through the outfield, out to the fences, where it used to be the grass, you know, the outfielders could cut the ball off because the grass sloped down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just everything is different. It's just, you can't, it's like comparing apples and oranges.
Yeah. do you think, where do you see, like, baseball going? You think it's, like, the offensive surge is going to continue, do you think? Because I know, I kind of like gradually the turf is starting to go out, because I think they were saying the other day there's only, like, three parks left with turf. But do you think the game will become, like, more strategic, or do you think it's still going to be just, like, hit the long ball?
Well, the fans don't come out to see 1-0.
Yeah, I do, but the fans.
Yeah, but... they like to see a lot of score, and they like to see home runs, and so that's what the owners are going to give them. If they have to make the fences shorter yet, they'll do it.
Yeah, that's like, just like with talking, like, about Braves Field, and I know, like, some, like, I'm trying to think, like, what were, there were some other bigger American League parks too, weren't they, during that era?
No, look at Cleveland.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The difference between the stadium and the new ballpark.
Yeah.
You know. And I see balls today. I see guys, you know, it used to be that when a guy hit a home run, when you saw a guy hit a home run, he really put everything into it. Now I see guys going like this today, and the ball goes out the ballpark.
Yeah, it's like,
I said, what's going on?
Yeah, like with the Rockies, I mean, Mike Hampton, he's got 5 home runs already, and it's kind of fun. That's another thing I wanted to ask you about the DH. Like, did you think pitchers back then, were they really, they make pitchers to be out to be horrible hitters. I mean, most of the time they are, but, like, pitchers, like pre-DH, like during the 50s, were all pitchers really, like, terrible hitters back then?
Yeah, they were pretty bad.
Were they?
Yeah, pretty
were they, bad. Were they still, like, was it kind of like how it is in the National League today, like where, like, kind of like how they do their double switches? Would they do that in the American League, and would they have the pitcher just bunt or pinch hit for them in the late innings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, same way that they do it in the American League. That's the way it always was before DH. You know, the pitchers, every time you can make a pitcher bunt, like, you're happy.
Yeah, it's like getting a double, practically, for some pitchers. I mean, the way I see some of them bunt today, I mean, geez.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they don't bunt it right off the bat into their face.
Yeah. They're pretty, people go to the big leagues with not near as much experience as they used to be when they went up through the minor leagues.
Yeah.
And you can see that the things that happen in the big leagues, and you say, how in the world, you know, how can a guy be a big leaguer and do something like that? But it's just, you know, they take kids out of college, and maybe they play 1 year in the minor leagues or something, and then they're in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to bunt. Pitchers don't know how to feel their position. So.
Yeah, that's what it's just so, the system, like, now, it's just so out of whack. I think with, like, the College World Series, how they're using metal bats, and it's almost like the hitters, you think they'd be at a disadvantage because they're using metal bats, and then they go to the minors, they have to adjust to the wood bat, and then find, like, you think that kind of slow them down, but yeah, and then you have the pitchers from college where they're thrown at these metal bats and basically hoping they have a 5 ERA for the year. I mean, but then you see, once they get to the majors, you just see the pitchers are getting slotted around again. It's just kind of...
Well, the thing is, that may change a little bit because of the strike zone thing.
Yeah.
The strike zone, when I was there, the strike zone, you know, the strikes were up here.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they got so that they had to be down here before they were striked.
Yeah.
And so that made the hitter, all he had to look at was one little spot there to pick a ball to hit.
Yeah.
Instead of being able to cover the whole plate.
Yeah.
So now, if the umpires come back and raise that strike zone, why, the hitters are not going to get so many home runs.
Yeah, especially I think that'll help, like, the power pitchers. Like, I know how Curt Schilling, he's really had, like a turnaround. Like, he really is using that upper three balls there for just to, like, smoke them in there with two strikes. Was it, like, a lot of, like, I know Bob Feller, did he use that high strike a lot when it was...
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, the thing is about a fastball pitcher, the faster they can make that ball spin like this, it'll raise a little bit. Just like a curveball curves like this and it goes down.
Yeah.
And so consequently, when you have to throw the ball down, well, you don't get that much spin.
Yeah.
When you can let that ball go up here and let it go off your fingers and spin it and reel and throw hard, in other words, the higher it is up here, the more it'll raise.
Yeah, and if you can get that little raise, I mean, even if it hits the bat, it still might just go back off the bat.
Just an easy fly.
Yeah, that too, yeah. But what would you say was your biggest thrill or most memorable moment of your playing career?
Well, I don't know. I didn't have too many of them. I got a few home runs, but they were few and far between.
did you like ever have like a big game that stuck out in your mind, like something like a two home run game or?
Not in the big leagues. No, I hit a memorable home run one time off of Bob Lemon.
Oh yeah.
When Cleveland was down in St. Louis, and Cleveland was they were fighting New York for the pennant. It was in September, I think, and. It was about the seventh inning, and we were a run or so behind, and there was two men on. And Lemon was always tough on me. He had such a wicked curveball. And I don't know what made me do it, but I just kind of run up in the box a little bit when he pitched, and I hit the ball, hit it out of ballpark. He was so mad. He followed me around the bases, cussing me out all the way around because I ran up on him.
Oh, yeah.
That was one thing that I never forgot.
Yeah, that's with those curveball pitchers. I mean, guys, like, they still, like, they'll get in the back of the box. I mean, if you're back there, it's too late. I mean, you got to be up in the box.
And, of course, he had a wicked curveball. That was his main pitch, was a curveball.
Yeah, just one other thing got me thinking about is trying to think... Yeah, okay, yeah. Like, with the syndicate ball, like, I know, like, I'm not sure it was earlier in the century, but I don't know if the 50s and the 40s, was there any, like, dual ownership with, like, I'm not sure if with Beck, did he ever own two teams, or were the Browns ever owned by...
I don't think anybody's allowed to do that, are they?
Because, well, I know, like, earlier, like, in the 1900s, like, some, I know, like, with the Browns, and I'm not sure who the owner was, and, like, I know with the Baltimore and the Dodgers, there was an owner where he would own both of them, and for a while, he put all the best players on the Dodgers and kind of left the Orioles to fall through there. That was kind of earlier in the century. I just wondered if there was any, like...
I never heard of that. No. Yeah. There was none of that then.
Oh, it wasn't? Okay. All right, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's pretty much all my questions there, but thanks so much for the interview.
Well, glad that I could help you out if I did.
Yeah. Okay.